Welcome, and thank you for standing by. All participants are on a listen-only mode until the question and answer session of today's conference. During the question and answer, please press star one on your touch-tone phone and record your name at the prompt. This call is recorded. I would now like to turn the call over to Ms. Amy Friedrich. Ma'am, you may now begin.
Thank you, Dee. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar. My name is Amy Friedrich, one of the organizers for today's call. Today's webcast is presented by the Illinois Department of Human Services, Division of Mental Health, and the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative. The title of today's webinar is DHS-DMH Training for New Rule 132 Providers, Part 2. The presenters will be from the Division of Mental Health, Dr. Mary Smith, Associate Director of Decision Support Research and Evaluation, and Richard Jones, MA Provider Access Specialist. And from the Collaborative, Sue Kappas, Clinical Service Manager, Brent Sparlin, Clinical Quality Assurance Analyst, Trish Gorda, Business System Analyst 2, and myself, Amy Friedrich, Training Coordinator. Today's training will cover the following topics: Provider Connect and Batch Registration, Consumer Registration, Authorization Request, Reimbursement and Submission of Claims to HFS, and Troubleshooting and Resolving Claims Issues. Before we begin the formal presentation, I would like to review with everyone a few helpful housekeeping items. If you happen to get disconnected from the audio portion, please call back into the same number you just dialed, which is 888-989-7686, and use your participant passcode, which is 3648714. Again, those numbers are 888-989-7686, and the participant passcode is 3648714. The visual portion of this presentation is web-based. Of course, you can choose the audio portion only, but if you would like to see the webinar PowerPoint presentations, the login information is located on the invite that you received after you registered. If you are experiencing any problems with this particular link to join, you may also go to www.joinwebinar.com and enter the webinar ID directly, which is 150-900-067. I will repeat that ID. It's 150-900-067. There will be a designated answer and or question and answer portion at the end of this, each presentation today. The operator will open up the lines for questions at that time. And lastly, at the conclusion of the presentation today, we ask that you please complete the brief satisfaction survey that will appear when you close out of the online forum. It should take less than 5 minutes to complete the survey, and we value your feedback. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Mary Smith.
Thanks, Amy. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us. We're excited to be moving into the realm of you folks being able to register individuals and submit claims. So day one, I know that you heard a lot about probably DMH's philosophy for services, and then also detailed information about Rule 132 mental health services. Day two, which is what we're doing today, is more of technical training. But just because it's technical training doesn't mean that this is only geared towards individuals who work with your reporting or IT system. The target audience for today would be lead clinicians. You know, again, there was a presentation on Rule 132 Medicaid services the first day of the training, but in order to be able to submit claims for individuals, you have to complete a registration. And so it's important to have someone listen in who will be working with individuals who seek services to interview them and then collect the information that's needed to support registrations, as well as service class authorizations. Target audience would also be the individual or individuals who are responsible for billing and claim submission. Here, we'd be looking for someone at the supervisory level who really works the process within the agency. And then it's always helpful to have other individuals from the agency on the line, you know, if they're available, to hear what we cover today. You know, because when you register or enroll with DMH and HFS to submit claims for mental health services, there are really a lot of requirements that are outside of just purely claim submission. As Amy said, we will cover a wide range of topics today, and so I think we'll just go ahead and move to Mr. Jones, who is the DMH Service Access Manager, to talk about provider enrollment. Rich?
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. I wanted to just kind of touch base and go over the provider enrollment process a little bit. Amy, if you can change the slide there for the next one. This is just more of the big picture overview that the new providers that are coming into DMH, that you understand that there are a lot of little different steps that need to occur for any new provider agency or even a down to a location that we need information on. We request a regional office, Division of Mental Health approval, as well as a central office approval. And we require a BALC or a DCFS certification that has that site listed exactly the way you would like to enroll it with HFS and our DMH database. We also require a unique NPI number. Every provider location site has to have a unique NPI number. That is a HIPAA requirement, and we are really stressing that. Some of our older providers still have a little confusion about this and have some issues involved, but it's very important to make sure this is correct for all the billing purposes and everything. There's certain HFS forms that are required, as well as collaborative forms. And then we need to do a synchronization between both of those systems before a site is finally enrolled and active. Next slide, please. This is just a quick overview. I won't go into this too much, but you'll get this slide presentation. Will be posted on the collaborative website, I'm sure, at the end of this soon. And you'll have links to these. And some of these you already have links because I've sent them to you for your agencies that have been enrolling. So next slide, please. Same here are some more additional HFS forms that are required. They're not actually the HFS forms, but the W-9, the tax information, and where to go to get an NPI number. And I really encourage providers to use this online insight access to the National Plan and Provider Enumeration System, because it seems to get a turnaround a lot faster than trying to do the 800 number and doing a call that way. And then next slide, please. Then once we have all these forms selected, we ask that you send those to the central office to my attention, because I'll need to authorize with HFS that you are indeed a enrolled and approved provider by DMH before we can get that site enrolled. And then I would also, if they had some specific questions, I would kind of serve as the conduit for some feedback from HFS if they had some things that they needed to get more attention on the forms. And then finally, the HFS enrollment is when they are PPU is completed, they will issue a provider key, and they send out a provider information sheet to the providers. I don't receive this sheet, so I strongly urge you when you get this to look very carefully, because this sheet will include your payee information and addresses and NPI numbers, so you do want to make sure the enrollment is correct. So please, next slide. Once we have that provider key or that Medicaid site ID, then we can start enrolling with the collaborative. And the collaborative has certain forms that are required, and they list them on this particular page with this link here. The form for changing a site location is what is called a Form 2. And this particular form will list everything from your Rule 132 services to your NPI number and your address. And it's very critical to get it accurate with your certificate when you do this enrollment. Next slide, please. And then the Form 1 for the collaborative is for the administrative information. We ask that you keep all of this information up to date. If you have a change in CEO or contact person or a new website or something, we want to keep this information current. And then the NPI numbers go on the NPI form that the collaborative has posted there as well. So the next slide, please. So this information, the HFS enrollment, the Medicaid number, and all of the information listed on these collaborative forms are inputted into the DMH provider database, and it's your responsibility as a provider to keep that database current and active. If there's any changes to a particular site, if you're changing the site location, everything has to be approved and reflected correctly, not only in the database but on your certificate as well. So we request that you modify anything using those particular forms, and we also do a regular review process as well to kind of validate to make sure that the information is correct, because if the information is inaccurate either at HFS PPU or at the collaborative, it's going to result in some kind of billing issue probably that will come back to haunt you. But we want to get the enrollment correct up front. Next slide, please. Now, when you're looking at our provider database, we do have regional offices, I mentioned, and I'll give you those contact numbers shortly. And some regional offices will assign you to a specific contract manager that will kind of be your liaison for any changes. So, for example, if you have a site and you want to move that site, your first point of contact would be to that regional office, and then the regional office would give their approval, and then you would then contact either BALC or DCFS to start the process of certifying the new site. So we want to keep that regional office very involved in reviewing these forms, and then they send all that information on up to my attention too, and then I authorize it prior to it getting updated by the collaborative. Next slide, please. And then on an annual basis, we have an online system for verifying the database, and it is a user interface where you can, when you are assigned and logged in to Provider Connect, and that's one of the next topics of this presentation this morning, you will be able to actually look at what's in the provider database as a PDV, and you can then update it and make changes to it for us. And we do that on an annual basis, too. I left my contact information if you need that here. It'll be on this slide. So let's go to the next slide and talk about the regions. We have divided the state out where the Chicago area, pretty much Cook County metro area, is what is called Region 1. And we have a Region 1 North, Central, and South offices. Those are your key directors that you would be working with depending on where you're located. And if you have any questions about who you would be working with at the region level, I would be glad to help facilitate that. Just send me an email. Each of these regions have regular meetings for their providers, and we very strongly urge you to stay in contact with them, because they are really your frontline person for when you have questions or issues. And it's great to always network with other providers and see what's going on in your particular area. Region 2 would be kind of the suburban area, and then the northern part of the state. Region 3 and 4 is the mid parts of the state from I-80 all the way down to about I-70. And then Region 5 is the far southern part of the state. Let's go to the next slide, please. We just need to pause just for a second. This has always been a issue trying to understand when we talk about enrollment for our new providers. We want to clarify again and again that it is a multi-step process. When you receive your first letter from Kathy Cumston that says this is a letter of support to pursue BALC certification, that does not mean you are ready to start claiming. There are a lot of other pieces that are required before you can become an enrolled and funding billing provider. So if you start on this light green box on the far left, this is the first step into the process, the gateway. It's all of our information posted on that website called Becoming a Medicaid Certified Community Mental Health Provider. There's really two tracks. We have some applicants that come in already with a DCFS certificate, and that track is listed on the left side. It's kind of like a pinkish color box. Those applicants, when they're reviewed and accepted by DMH, we then give them a letter of support to provide the services, and then we start moving to the purple box where we start getting you enrolled with all of HFS and the collaborative. For those providers that do not have a certificate, they go up to the top part of the light blue box up there where we issue that letter of support to become a Rule 132 certificate with BALC. And then there's a different group of people that you'll be working with. It is the BALC office. It's a different division within the Department of Human Services, and you will be working with their staff to do what is called the certification review. And they will have extensive information that they will require of you from a perspective of how you're going to meet the rule. And they will also coordinate getting the fire marshal inspection done, too. So if you are one of those providers that have just recently gotten a letter of support and you have not contacted BALC yet, if you look at that letter of support, it tells you specifically to contact Tracy Aiden at BALC and start the process going. So I urge you to do that. So once you have either a BALC certificate or a DCFS certificate, we then work on the enrollment with HFS and the collaborative. Kind of at the same time, we can also start the training phase, which is what we're in the middle of doing now with you today. We had the 132 training a few weeks ago, and now we're talking about the actual processes, as Dr. Smith referred to earlier. Some providers, if you are working with children, we will want you to get enrolled with DATSTAT, and then we may look at making sure you understand the functional assessment tools and that are required for enrollment of and obtaining a consumer registration, such as the Columbia or Ohio scales if you're working with kids, or LOCUS if you're working with adults. So we have a whole process of training we have to do, and then the next step is that light blue one where then you are finally then able to start getting connected up with Provider Connect, which is the site that's run by the collaborative that gives you access as a provider. And then finally, then DHS will need to work with HFS to list you as a funded provider. And then at the very end of this step, the last green box, then you will finally get an email that says you've received permission to enroll as a DMH provider, register consumers, and submit subsequent DMH Rule 132 claims for services rendered. So this is kind of a long process to get to this, but I just wanted to make sure everybody had that up front so that you understand that not until you receive that final letter, that's when you can finally start rolling out and becoming active. So that's all I have to present today, and thank you, and we'll turn to presentation back over to Amy.
All right. Thank you, Rich. I will start by giving you an overview of Provider Connect. Provider Connect is a free online secure application. It is a portal into the collaborative MIS system and is accessed via the collaborative website. Today, we will review how to access Provider Connect, how to register, re-register, and close a consumer's case, and what resources are available. Several tools are available within Provider Connect, and these include the ability to register a consumer, view consumer registration status, and close a registration. You can also view authorizations, view and print authorization letters, access and print forms, and submit inquiries to customer service. There are several benefits to using Provider Connect, and those include routine information can be easily accessed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Provider Connect is accessed through the collaborative website at www.illinoismentalhealthcollaborative.com. It also allows for multiple transactions to be completed in one session. Information may be viewed and printed, and calls for routine information are reduced. In order to access Provider Connect, you must be enrolled with the Collaborative and HFS, and you must have a provider ID number assigned by Beacon Options. To obtain a provider ID number, you'll need to contact National Network at 800-397-1630. Each provider is allowed one Provider Connect logon ID. If more than one Provider Connect logon ID is needed, you will need to contact Beacon Options at EDI Help Desk at 888-247-9311 and press option 3. The Help Desk is available 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Central Standard Time, and please note that there is a 48-hour turnaround time when requesting additional logons. Before you can access Provider Connect, you must first register as a user by taking the following steps. You will need to go to the Collaborative website and click on For Providers. This brings up the Provider Online Services page. You will then click Register, and you will be taken to the Provider Online Services registration page. You will need to complete all applicable fields there, and note that all fields with a red asterisk are required fields. Please keep the following requirements in mind when creating your password. The password must be 8 to 20 characters in length, contain one number 0 through 9, contain one uppercase letter A through Z, and contain one special characteristic shown here, and must not contain any spaces. And also note that passwords are case sensitive and will expire every 90 days. This screen shows the provider online what the provider online services screen looks like, and this is where you will register for a password and log on into Provider Connect. Registering consumers is important as the information submitted during registration is used for enrollment of individuals for DMH purchase services, to determine the eligibility group for which the consumer is qualified for, which in turn determines what services DHS and DMH will reimburse. The requirements for initiating registration are to obtain a consumer RIN, which is a recipient identification number, and a DHSSS, which is the DHS Social Services from HFS. Registration information will be updated within 5 business days. Beacon will then process registration and assign funds. Beacon then sends fund information to HFS within 1 business day. And HFS processes the file, either accepts or rejects, and sends results to Beacon by the 2nd business day. There are several scenarios where you will need to access the registration screen. When registering a new consumer, when registering a new consumer and closing from services at the same time, when registering a consumer who has been previously closed, when re-registering a consumer, which is required every 6 months to maintain eligibility for submission of claims, and when closing a registration of a consumer. When we begin the live demo, I will show you 2 methods for accessing the registration screen. That's via the specific consumer search and register a consumer without first searching for a member. The Collaborative highly recommends that you use the specific consumer search option for the following reasons. This option verifies the consumer is on file with the Collaborative, and when you navigate to the register screen after searching for the consumer, many of the demographic fields will have been pre-populated for you. So choosing the register a consumer link without first searching for a consumer will require all the demographic information to be entered before the system can determine if the consumer is on file. Before we begin the live demo to register a consumer, I'd like to point you to the Provider Connect registration guide dated June 2013 version. It is available on the Collaborative's website. You will click on For Providers and then Provider Information, which is a link to the left. Then the document can be found in the registration section, or you can access the guide directly using the web address shown here. The Provider Connect guide provides an overview of the registration process and a detailed description of information required to complete the registration process. We will now go to the live demo. This is the Provider Connect login screen that appears when you select login from the Provider Online Services page on the Collaborative's website. Before I log in, I'd like to point out the contact information below the Register button under New User. This is the number you'd use for assistance with any Provider Connect access issues. So after you've entered your user ID and your password, I'm going to click Login. Let me try that again. Here we go. Once you log in, the user agreement page will appear. Read through the agreement, and then click I agree at the bottom here. A pop-up will appear. Just click OK. Give it a few minutes to load. From your provider homepage, you will see the links on the left and under your message center here. The links to the left include options for specific consumer search. Here it says specific member search. And right below that, register a member. As I previously mentioned, the Collaborative highly recommends that you use a specific member search method rather than register a consumer. These two options are also located under your message center, under what do you want to do today. Going to click on Find a Specific Member, and we will need to use your customer identification number. Give it a few minutes to load. I apologize, it's taking some extra time to load. right. Sorry that took some time. This will take you to the eligibility and benefits search screen. Both consumer ID and the date of birth are required fields. So this brings up the consumer demographics screen. You will see four other tabs here that you can reference at a later date. They include the enrollment history, COB, the benefits, and additional information. To begin the registration process, you'll need to click the View Consumer Registration button, which is located here. Here we are. You just scroll down a little bit, and you'll see that it says no records found. So if no existing registrations are found for the agency, a no records found message will display in the consumer registration list here. So we're going to click on Add Consumer Registration. And please note the following. As you can see, some of the demographic fields are pre-populated since you searched for a member prior to registering. Any fields that are pre-populated can be overwritten as needed. All fields with an asterisk are required and must be populated. If you try to move on to the next screen without completing a required field, the field heading will turn red and an error message will appear at the top of the screen. We will begin to register. The registration start date is the begin date for the six-month registration period, and it cannot be backdated more than 90 days. It can also not be future dated. You'll enter the agency seen here. The satellite code is an optional numeric value between 0 and 99. The Medicaid site ID is the HFS assigned Medicaid site ID number where the client is registered. The last name and first name are pre-populated. Date of birth is also pre-populated. Enter the mother's maiden name. And the Social Security must be valid or you need to click unknown. So if the Social Security number is not known, then click the unknown radio button and the Social Security field will default to all nine. And if the consumer has no Social Security number, then you will also click the No Social Security Number button, and it will default to all zeros. You need to enter the primary address. If the address is not known, then click Address Unknown. Address 2 is not required. City, state, and zip have pre-populated. Down here to a county, select the drop-down box, and select the county and the township. This is where you will click a yes or no if the consumer is a Williams-class consumer. In this case, we're going to choose no. The IMD home code is only required if you've selected yes. Here we will enter the total monthly income of all family members in the household at the time of registration. You can round to the nearest dollar. This is where you will click or indicate the total monthly income of the consumer at the time of registration. You'll need to enter the household size. in the household composition. And then the education level. Military status and marital status, employment status, Social Security eligibility, and the donated funds in the initiative or contracted funds initiative here. Support of forensic treatment here. For race, all five fields are required. If one race is noted, then all others can, we can click 98, which is nothing to report. Citizenship, you will click here. Hispanic origin. Language preferred. And if there is interpreter services needed. And the MH residential arrangements here. Justice system involvement, and if there is any DMH special projects, this indicates either the disaster that brought the consumer to Illinois or the SMRF initiative. If the consumer has a third-party payer, and the MH residential indicator, this designates whether or not the consumer is enrolled in the DHS fund, funded MH fill-up program. Here we're going to click no. This takes you to the special program enrollment. Click no for all of these. Then we'll scroll down here to permanent supportive housing, and money follows the person. That takes us to the MH closing, which we are not closing the consumer, so we will just click next. This field at the top indicates that I did not complete a required field, so I need to find that field, which is right here. Click not in a residential program. Then I will click next again. So note the following. These are the selected funds available. Then we'll click next. This indicates the selected funds available, the effective date, and the expiration date. And please note that at this point, it is not guaranteed the consumer will be registered for any or all of these funds. At the very end of the registration process, you will be informed if the registration has been approved and the exact funds that have been assigned for the consumer. So this is the diagnosis page where you enter the diagnosis code and the first presentation assessment information. variants and diagnosis codes here. Take it down to axis 3. And moving on down to first impression, first presentation assessment. I'm sorry. And you're going to click yes for all of those if they apply. And then we're going to click Next. And this takes us to the GAF and CGAF score locus results. So here is where we will enter the CGAF score. The CGAF score is for children under 18. This consumer is over 18, so we're going to go down and enter the GAF score here. And then we are going to scroll down and enter any locus information results that we have. And then I'm going to click Next. It's going to pop up all these red fields that were required fields that I missed. So you'll need to go back and complete those. Scroll down and hit Next again. And this is going to take you to the history of illness. You'll need to complete these fields. Continuous treatment of 6 months or more in one or more combination of the following treatment modalities. Going to click Does Not Meet. Go ahead and just buzz through these. And click Next. And this takes you to the MH Cross Disabilities page. For your date here. And enter all the information accordingly. And then click Next. And this will take us to the Guardian information. going to leave that blank. Give it a few minutes to load here. And this is going to take you to the consumer registration and confirmation page, and you'll see the status is approved. And here are the funding sources and description, along with the start date and end date. They will be indicated here. And please note that all of the registration screens are included in the PowerPoint presentation, which will be posted to the Collaborative website within the next few days. The MP3 recording will also be available on the Collaborative website. So at this time, we're going to re-register a member, so I'm going to return to the homepage. Got a few minutes to load. And now we are back at the home page, and we are going to re-register a member. But first, we need to view consumer registration. This will show the funds. This will show the consumer registration, and we're going to click on re-register here. And also, if we were wanting to close the registration, we would close that here, or if we need to change the address, we would do that here. So you will click here to re-register. Remember to re-register a consumer and update key fields to extend coverages every 6 months. You re-register a consumer and update key fields and close a registration at the same time. Example, if the previous registration on file for the consumer was past the six-month timeline, and at that time of re-registration, the consumer no longer wanted services, you could do them both at the same time. When you re-register a consumer, you need to update the key fields and end date a special program. An example of that would be when a special program is being closed and the consumer needed to be re-registered for other funds. So after you will complete all this information to re-register, and then after you have done that, I also showed you where you could close the registration. And then the previous consumer registration will appear, as I show you here. And then there is the existing consumer registration will appear, and some fields have been populated for you. And please note that you'll need to enter the registration start date, which is used to calculate the six-month registration period. And once you click next, you'll be taken through the remaining registration screen. So now we'll just go home. And this warning here is showing you that if you return, you will lose any data that you have entered if you do not fully go through the whole process. So that is important to note. All right, and then finally, I want to discuss the multiple RIN resolutions. You can call the collaborative. Let me go back to my presentation one moment. I'll get that information up for you. All of the information that I showed you on the live demo, there are slides included with that you can reference at a later date. First, I want to point out the customer support telephone numbers. Here are these numbers you can use for certain issues that you have, and here is the EDI help desk number listed for you as well. And then for multiple RIN resolutions, which I was speaking about a second ago, you can call the collaborative at 866-359-7953 and select the provider menu and then press 1. And a collaborative eligibility specialist will then work with DMH, and DMH directs the collaborative to keep or merge each RIN. And how to handle consumer name and date of birth changes. The consumer's name and date of birth that the collaborative has on file is received from HFS. So if the consumer's name or date of birth is incorrect, the corrections need to be made with HFS. And then HFS will then notify the collaborative through the eligibility file we get from them daily. At this time, I will turn the call over to Trish Gorder, who will cover batch registration.
Good afternoon, everybody. So during this portion of the training, I'll review what's needed to submit batch registrations. And then I'll walk through the screens to submit an actual batch registration file. So to have a complete understanding of everything you'll need to successfully submit batch registration files, you will need to refer to the batch registration submission guide, which is available on the collaborative website. So in the guide, you're going to find a lot of helpful information, some of which is how to obtain a submitter ID and a password. You're going to find information on file specifications required for your batch file, such as the file type and the file length, and also trailer record specifications. You'll also find a batch file layout showing all of the field names and the descriptions, as well as the field lengths and positions. And you'll also find information on error processing, such as the error codes and descriptions. So in the last demo, Amy showed you how to register an individual consumer using the online registration screens in Provider Connect. So in this portion of the training, I'll show you how to submit multiple registrations on a specially formatted batch file using the batch registration submission process, which is also available in Provider Connect. But first, I just wanted to show you where you'll be able to find the batch registration submission guide. As I said, you can find it on the collaborative website. And you'll find it on the provider information page. And on that page is a section titled Registration. And that's the section that you'll find the batch registration submission guide. So now I'll walk you through the screens to submit a batch registration file. As I said, it's available in Provider Connect. So what you'll do is you'll log into Provider Connect as usual, and from your provider homepage, there's an option on the left-hand menu called EDI Homepage. And so you'll click that option. And so this is the EDI homepage, and from this page, you can submit batch files. You'll also be able to see the batch files that you've previously submitted. And then you can also retrieve your response files. And I'll be going over response files in more detail in a bit. But first, let's continue with our submit batch process here. So then what you would do to submit your batch file, to start that process, is you're going to click the Submit Batch File button. So then in step one of the process, you're going to select the form type of batch reg from this drop-down field, and then you're going to click Next. In step two of the process, this would be the area where you would answer some form-based questions. However, with the batch reg form type, there are no form-based questions, so you're going to simply click Next on this screen. And then in step three of the process, this is where you're going to upload your batch file. So you're going to click the Browse button, and you're going to locate and upload your file. And once you've uploaded your file, then you're going to click the Submit button. And then this last screen here of the process is telling you that your file was submitted successfully and that you're going to receive an email shortly containing your submission number. You'll need to make note of this submission number because that's how you're going to identify your response files. So one thing I wanted to point out, though, your batch file may have been submitted successfully at this point. However, the file still needs to go through several file formatting checks, and if any one of these checks fail, then your batch file is going to reject. So, in other words, my point is, just because you see this screen saying that your file was submitted successfully and you received an email with a submission number, it doesn't mean that your batch file was accepted. So the only way that you're going to know if your batch file was accepted is by downloading the summary response file coinciding with the submission number, and that's to verify that your batch file was accepted. If the summary file shows that the batch file was rejected, then you'll need to correct the batch file and resubmit it. So there are several reasons that your batch file could be rejected, and the reasons are going to be shown on that summary response file, so that's why it's really important to get that downloaded. Some of the reasons could be that your batch file may not be formatted correctly. So in that case, the summary response file is going to indicate that your file had an invalid file format. There could have also been issues with your trailer record. If the trailer record didn't exist, then the message will indicate that. Also, if there's any kind of field formatting issues on your trailer record, then the summary response file is going to indicate what those issues with the trailer record were. So, and as I mentioned a little bit earlier, it's really important to review that batch registration submission guide, because that guide is going to give you all the information that you need to submit these batch registration files successfully. So, assuming that your batch file is accepted, now I'm going to cover the other types of response files that you could receive. So, for every batch file you submit, you can receive up to three response files. The first, you're always going to receive a summary response file, which I just mentioned a minute ago. That's going to indicate whether your batch file was accepted or rejected. And as I said, if your batch file is rejected, this is the only response file you're going to receive. You'll be able to see the reason that the batch file rejected when you download and view this response file. So if your batch file is accepted, of course, the summary response file will indicate that. It's also going to indicate the number of registration records that were accepted and the number of registration records that rejected. So So if your batch file was accepted and the summary response file shows a number of registration records that were accepted, you're also going to receive an accepted response file. So that's the second type of file that you could receive for your submission. So if the summary response file shows that zero registration records were accepted, then you won't receive this accepted response file. So then finally, if your batch registration file is accepted and the summary response file shows that a number of registration records were rejected, then you're also going to receive an error response file. This is the third type of response file that you can receive. If your summary file shows that zero registration records were rejected, then of course you're not going to receive an error response file. So let me summarize that. If your batch file is accepted and you have some registration records that were accepted and some that were rejected, you're going to receive three separate files: a summary response file, an accepted response file, and an error response file. It's absolutely critical that you download all of these response files as soon as you receive them to ensure that any rejected batch files or registration records are corrected as soon as possible and resubmitted. So now I'm going to show you how to retrieve those response files. And to do that, you're going to return to your EDI homepage from Provider Connect. And you're going to find your response file down here in the incoming file section. Our example here shows that three files that all contain the same batch submission number, and each file ends in a different letter. That letter is going to indicate what type of file it is. So for the summary response file, that file name is going to end in an R. For the accepted response file, that file name ends in A. And for the error response file, that file name ends in E. So the first file that you're going to want to retrieve is your summary file, which, of course, as I said, is going to tell you if your batch file was accepted or rejected. So you're just going to click on the hyperlinked file name to download it. And then you're brought to the View Incoming Files. Again, you're going to click on the same file name to download the file. And then this screen shows you that the downloaded files. If the response file downloaded successfully, you can click Yes here, and you'll return to the EDI homepage in case you have more response files to download. If your response file did not download successfully, then you can click the No button. And you can try to download the response file again using the EDI homepage. Or you can also try downloading the file directly to your computer by right-clicking on the file name and selecting Save As. And, of course, if you have any issues and need assistance submitting your batch file, you can contact the EDI Help Desk at the number shown here. So now I'd like to turn the call over to Sue Campos.
Thanks, Trish. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Sue Campos. I'm the Clinical Services Manager at the Collaborative. This part of the presentation will step through the process of submitting utilization management requests for services through the use of Provider Connect for assertive community treatment and community support team. There are two ways that a provider can submit an ACT or a CST authorization request. You can submit it online at www.IllinoisMentalHealthCollaborative.com/providerswithanS.htm, or you can submit it through the fax, 866-928-7177. The DMH requires the collaborative to respond to requests for authorizations within specific turnaround times. For an initial request for an ACT or a CST request, it's one business day of receipt of a complete initial auth that does exclude holidays and weekends, and three business days for a complete reauthorization request. The requirements for the initial authorization request are for consumers that are not currently receiving ACT. The treating provider will submit an ACT packet. And in that packet, you should include the ACT authorization request form that will ask you to document the consumer's locus information for adults. If you're requesting CST, you'll also need to put in the CST authorization request form. That also has a place for the locus on it, and it also has a place for Ohio scale results for children ages 15 through 17. That packet should also include the initial treatment plan with ACT or CST listed as a service, the consumer's initial crisis plan, and the mental health assessment. So once the initial ACT or CST request is submitted, the documents are reviewed for adherence to clinical criteria based on the service definitions, Rule 132, and the authorization treatment guidelines. If the clinical criteria are met for the services, the collaborative clinician will enter an initial authorization for 90 days of service if only an MHA is submitted. If a treatment plan is submitted, the clinician can enter an authorization for 12 months for an ACT request. Now, it's a little different for CST. If a treatment plan is submitted for a CST, the initial authorization can be up to 6 months. Before the initial authorization expires, the ACT or the CST team is to submit a reauth request if the consumer continues to require ACT or CST. This request can be submitted 14 calendar days in advance of the authorization expiration date. Now, to request a reauthorization for a consumer who is currently receiving ACT or CST, the treating provider will submit another packet, and that will include an updated ACT authorization request form that includes updated information about the locus score or the Ohio. If you're submitting for CST, you'll, of course, need the updated CST request form. Need an updated treatment plan and the consumer's crisis plan. Once the request for the reauthorization of ACT or CST is submitted, the documents, again, are reviewed for adherence to clinical criteria based on the service definition and Rule 132 and authorization treatment guidelines. And if the clinical criteria is met for services, the collaborative will enter an authorization for either 9 months for the ACT or 12 months for the ACT, depending on the length of the initial authorization. For CST, it would be 6 months or 180 days. And again, the same policy applies here. Before the reauthorization expires, the ACT or the CST team is to submit a reauthorization request if the consumer continues to require ACT or CST. It can be submitted 14 calendar days in advance. The next couple slides are an example. The first one is an example of an ACT request for authorization form. It can be found on the collaborative website. I do want to point out that the form has been somewhat modified to include checkboxes for enhanced skills training, or EST, in-home recovery support, IHR. These are specialized services only for Williams class members. So basically, on this form, you would check off whether or not it's an initial request or a reauth request for ACT or CST, fill in all of your agency's information, the RIN number, the name of the consumer, and if you could, please provide us two contacts, one for clinical and one for registration questions. And we will require not only the person's name and phone number, but a fax number and an encrypted email address. This next section deals with submitting the request online through Provider Connect. You can access Provider Connect via the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative's website. We'll log into Provider Connect. There are two places that you can enter the auth request, on the left-hand side or the one in the middle. Next page is a disclaimer page. Read that and select next. Brings you to your member search page. You'll need the consumer's RIN number and date of birth. Next screen is the member demographics screen. Verify that the member's demographics are correct and select next. Brings you to the provider location screen. Select your agency's address here. And the next screen is the requested services header. You'll put in the requested start date that you would like the authorization to begin. The type of service is mental health. The level of care, the ACT or CST, whichever service you're requesting. And the level of service is outpatient. This is also the place where you would attach any of your supporting clinical documents, your MHA, your treatment plan, your crisis plan, one of the request forms. You can also fax in the clinical. There's also a section where you would put contact information for the person that we would call if we have clinical questions. Phone number, fax, an encrypted email address, as well as name. Next screen is the service definition criteria. Please check all that apply. This screen's an example of an ACT request. On the ACT request, it asks for dates of acute inpatient stays. You'll need the name of the hospital and the dates. The next screen is the diagnoses screen. Complete all five axes. If there's no diagnosis code, please use one of the V codes. And all of the diagnoses information pre-populates from the registration. The current GAF score is pre-populated, but you will have to enter the highest GAF score in the past year. Next screen is the locus information. There's also a narrative box. This reason for deviation narrative holds 200 characters. We're looking for a score for CST between, a composite score between 17 and 22. For ACT, it's 20 and 22. If it deviates from that, we would ask that you'd write a reason for deviation in that narrative box. The next screen is medications. So we will need the name of the psychotropic medication, the dosage, the frequency, and the prescriber. The last screen is the determination status screen, and at the bottom it will show you various printing and downloading options. can print the auth request, download an authorization request, return to provider home. Notices of discontinuation for ACT or CST services are required if you stop working with one of the consumers or the consumer moves out of the geographic area. And you can fill out one of those forms, and you can fax the form to the collaborative at 866-928-7177. All of the criteria for discontinuation are outlined in the authorization protocol manual that's located on the collaborative's website. Just you would go up into the provider manual under Roman numeral 3B for team services. Detailed information regarding discontinuation of ACT services and linkage to other services has to be documented in the consumer's clinical record. The next screens are examples of an ACT and a CST notification form. There's a place on there right under admit date of ACT for the date that the consumer was discontinued, and there's a list of reasons of why a consumer may be discontinued. I will now turn it over to Brent, and he will discuss how to submit an auth request for therapy counseling, PSR, and CSG.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Brent Sparlin. I'm the Collaborative's Clinical Quality Assurance Analyst. And so much of the steps used in ACT, CST are going to be mirrored through the PSR, CSG, and therapy counseling. Provider may submit a therapy counseling or CSG PSR authorization request using the following method only. You submit online at www.illinoismentalhealthcollaborative.com providers.htm. I'm sorry, that's a backward. So supporting clinical documentation not attached to the online request may be faxed to 866-928-7177. DHS DMH requires the collaborative to respond to requests for authorizations within 7 business days of receipt for all these services. This excludes holidays and weekends. The collaborative staff verifies the information for completeness. The information in the request is consistent with information found in the supporting documentation. If there are inconsistencies, the provider will be contacted regarding them. If additional clinical information is required, the clinician will contact the provider to obtain clinical information via telephone, and the clinical information will be documented in the review. The collaborative's clinical care managers, or CCMs, review submitted documents for the following 3 elements. 1, to determine completeness, to determine adherence to Rule 132, and to determine adherence to medical necessity criteria. If the above 3 elements are met for the services, the CCM will enter an authorization. If medical necessity is established, the request is authorized by the CCM and communicated to the provider in writing. Or if medical necessity is not established, the CCM contacts the provider to seek clarification and offer education, consultation regarding authorization criteria. The collaborative and the provider will reach mutual agreement with respect to the next steps, whether additional information will be submitted for review or alternative service will be considered. If a mutual agreement has not occurred and the provider believes medical necessity is present, the CCM will forward the information to a collaborative physician advisor or PA reviewer. The PA reviews and either authorizes or denies the authorization. So getting started, much just as you would with ACT and CST, you are going to go to the Provider Connect website, and that, again, is the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative website. You're going to go to the provider page, and you're going to log on to Provider Connect. Here again, you have two options once you reach there. Either enter an authorization request to the left, or if you go about halfway down, it says enter an authorization request. Again, you'll come with the disclaimer, and you'll want to press hit next at that point. Same way of searching for a member, you need the consumer's REN and date of birth. You're also going to have to enter the member demographics, provider location, selecting your agency address, and the requested services header. This, too, the level of service will be outpatient, type of service is mental health, and level of care is either going to be therapy counseling, psychosocial rehab, or community support treatment. The requested start date, we cannot backdate for these services, so it's going to have to be the date that you submit, or later. It can be a little later. Request services continued. Just like with CST and ACT, there will be space there for the clinical staff to contact, phone number, fax number, and a place for an encrypted email address. Diagnosis, all five diagnoses have to be addressed. Any blank codes, just use the V71.09. Same thing for the psychotropic medications. Just like CST, ACT, you'll enter the medication, the dosage, the frequency, and the prescriber. And then with the locus, we go by, it's going to vary for each level of service, and we have a slide that addresses that. So there is a spot for a reason for deviation, the narrative entry, so that would be required if the composite score does not meet medical needs criteria. We also have a spot for the Ohio scales, the Devereaux scales, and then we have suggestion for required documentation, and you can see here you can attach these, or we may have to request these if you don't send them. One is the mental health assessment dated within the past year, individual treatment plan dated within the past 6 months, mental health assessment update if indicated, or other clinical documentation that would support medical needs criteria. Then we also have the service requested, and you'll see here services requested can be therapy counseling, individual, group, or family. Please note that at this point, we cannot extend the end date beyond the end of the fiscal year. So, for example, if you submitted a request now, we would not be able to extend that beyond June 30th of this year. And then it would start over on July 1st. Also need information regarding transition or discharge plan. And addresses barriers to discharge. In the narrative section, we would expect you to enter information regarding reason for requesting service, what symptoms or behavior is the consumer exhibiting, what progress is the consumer making towards the identified goals, what benefit has the consumer demonstrated from this service, and then a description of what your discharge or transition plan is. And then we also have the determination status with, again, ways that you can download the request or the status. If the consumer does not have Medicaid, you will receive a call from the clinician that is processing your request for services, informing that your request has been administratively denied due to not having Medicaid enrollment in our system. At that time, you will be instructed to resubmit the request with a Medicaid-eligible RIN. If the consumer is Medicaid-eligible and it is not reflected in our system, you will be asked to submit verification documents to show verification of Medicaid eligibility. Our clinical department will forward this information to our eligibility department to be researched. If determined to be eligible, the records will be updated in our system, allowing the authorization request to be completed. Prior to a denial, the collaborative staff will support consumers and providers by offering alternative services that can meet the consumer's needs in the least restrictive setting. Appeals can be requested by a provider on behalf of a consumer by calling collaborative at 866-359-7953. Reconsideration requests must be received within 30 days of receipt of the denial. Reconsideration requests would then be reviewed by a psychiatrist employed by the collaborative who was not involved in the original decision and is not a subordinate of the psychiatrist who made the original decision. The provider, consumer, or designated representative disagrees with the outcome of the reconsideration request. An appeal may be filed within 5 days from the decision date of the reconsideration request. This review shall not be a clinical review, but rather an administrative review to ensure that all applicable appeal procedures have been correctly applied and followed. The final administrative decision shall be subject to judicial review exclusively as provided in the administrative review law. Once again, here are the numbers for the EDI Help Desk, 888-247-9311. They're available 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Central Standard Time, Monday through Friday. Again, examples of technical issues, account disabled, forgot password, system freezing or crashing, systems unavailable due to system errors. And that brings us to questions. I'll take it back to the lead, Mary Smith.
Thanks, Brent. So we're a little bit ahead, which is good news, because perhaps we'll be done before 4 o'clock. So I think I'll just go ahead with my presentation before we take any questions. So, Amy, will you be displaying my PowerPoint?
Yes, I have it displayed. One moment, Mary.
Great. I can see it now, Amy.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yep, thank you. Okay, so I'm going to reiterate a few of the things that you've heard today. And the reason that I'm reiterating it is because once agencies are really ready to start enrolling consumers and submitting claims, we found that they have lots of questions, you know, despite the fact that we covered them here. So I thought, you know, let's go over and reiterate a few points, and then we'll also post this presentation on the collaborative website with the other training material so that you have it for reference. Amy, can we go to the next slide, please? Problems moving on, Amy? Okay, there we go. Maybe it's just a little bit of a delay.
Yes, there's just a delay. Sorry about that.
No problem. So, you know, again, I'm going to recap a couple of important things here. So just in terms of, everyone's always anxious to submit a claim for DMH services, but again, just a quick recap of things that Rich covered, our service access manager. You must have all phases of provider enrollment completed before you can submit a claim and before you can submit a registration. So that means, again, you have to have your Rule 132 certification. You have to be enrolled with Health Care and Family Services. That includes all sites from which services will be rendered. You have to be enrolled, do DMH provider enrollment through the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative for Access and Choice using the slides that Rich covered earlier. And finally, the most important thing, or one of the most important things of all, you must wait until you receive direct notification from the DMH Service Access Manager, that's Mr. Jones, that individuals may be enrolled with DMH. And so, you know, again, just because we're going through the training today and you might be all set to go, don't start seeing individuals for treatment because you won't be able to basically enroll those folks or bill for services until you get that email from Rich. Remember, you know, again, we can't emphasize enough, any changes in sites, that's additions, closures, whatever, change of address, all of these things must be approved by DMH, and the HFS provider enrollment system and the DMH collaborative provider enrollment system must be updated. They have to be updated simultaneously, and they have to be synchronized. If they're not, you know, if you just go ahead and make a change with HFS, the odds are you're going to be getting some remittance advice showing rejected claims. And then you'll be puzzled. So we don't want you to be puzzled. We want to make sure that everything is synchronized between the two systems. Amy, will you go to the next slide, please? Eligibility for services. So, all of you guys are new Rule 132 Medicaid mental health providers. That means that you can only bill for individuals who are eligible for Medicaid. And I know that Brent covered some of that in his presentation when he talked about obtaining service authorizations for some of the DMH threshold services. So, you know, it's up to every provider, and especially you guys, because despite the fact that you may have seen some other funds displayed when Trish walked through her presentation or when Amy walked through her presentation, the reality is Rule 132 Medicaid providers only have one fund that they can bill against, and that's Medicaid. So you really need to make sure that individuals have Medicaid eligibility if you want DMH to reimburse you for the services. Providers are responsible for determining individuals' eligibility before providing services that are billed to DMH. Can't emphasize that enough. If you don't know it, go out there and check the MEDI system to determine a person's an individual status. So, again, critical. Remember, Rule 132, Medicaid mental health providers will not be reimbursed for non-Medicaid services. And they won't be reimbursed for individuals who are not Medicaid eligible. I'm sure when you attended the first presentation, day one, the orientation, there was some discussion of DMH eligibility. There's a list, as I'm sure was discussed, of diagnosis codes that pertain to individuals who are eligible for services. There's other eligibility criteria. So in addition to being Medicaid eligible, an individual has to also meet DMH's eligibility criteria. Amy, can we go to the next slide, please? Okay, consumer enrollment. So, you know, again, I'm just going to reemphasize this again, individuals for whom you're submitting claims must be registered with DMH through the DMH Collaborative Information System. In order to enroll individuals, and again, Amy and Trish covered this, it's really critical that the person have an active recipient identification number, also referred to as a RIN, and that they have Social Services Package B status. If they don't have those two things, if you try to enroll them, one, it's impossible to enroll an individual without a RIN. Two, if you try to enroll someone without Social Services Package B, if you're submitting a batch registration, for example, you'll just find that your registration was rejected. If you need RINs, you can request those RINs through the DHS eRIN system. So in order to also then, once you're enrolled in the eRIN system, in order to request RINs or Social Services Package B, you have to obtain a DHS ID, and again, you must be registered for the eRIN system. So displayed on the graph, I have the website address that you can access to obtain or complete an application for enrollment in the eRIN system and to obtain a DHS ID. So my recommendation, you know, when you go to that page, you'll see that there's an eRIN user manual. Please review the eRIN user manual before you make the request for the DHS ID and or a RIN. It'll just be helpful for you. So when you complete the form that I'm referring to also, that form must be approved by a DMH regional staff person before that form is submitted to DHS. Amy, can we go to the next slide, please? Thanks. Now, you know, once you have access to the eRIN system, again, you can go out and see if an individual has been assigned a RIN and whether or not that RIN is active. Again, just by logging in through the system to take a look and look at a person's status. If you don't see Social Services Package B status and a person has a RIN, you must request Social Services Package B status. And you can, again, do that through the eRIN system. You'll get a return to your request letting you know that the status has been assigned. When you do that, we recommend that you wait at least 48 hours before submitting a registration, because that Social Services Package B status must be added to the HFS eligibility file. Let's see what else here. I think I've already said this, but again, you have to have an active approved registration on file with the collaborative before any claim can be submitted. So just another couple of things to reiterate, even though we've just heard the detail of how to do these things. To submit a registration, you're submitting them as batch files or through Provider Connect. Registrations must be updated every 6 months or, as necessary, with all required fields updated. If you look at the batch registration guide or if you go to the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative website through the provider portal, there should be a list of fields that are required for those six-month updates. Amy walked through them when she did the demo on re-registering. We actually do use that information, and we take a look at, you know, where people were at the initial registration and then where they are by the end of the year or by the end of treatment. You can update the registration. For example, if an individual's address changes, we actually ask that you go in and update that address before the six-month period is up. We do use those addresses occasionally to do consumer perception of care surveys, so it's important that addresses be updated on file and accurate. As Amy walked through the registrations, you know, I talked about who this training was targeted for at the beginning. You probably noticed that what we require is a mixture of demographic, descriptive, and clinical information, and that some of that information carries right over into the authorization. So it really is critical that, you know, as your clinical staff are doing their assessments, that you accurately record all of the information that you'll need in order to register an individual. One of the things that we require is, you know, occasionally and maybe more frequently now, some of the individuals that you serve may be enrolled with managed care. DMH has an agreement with HFS and with the managed care organizations that individuals receiving these Rule 132 services are to have a registration maintained with DMH and the collaborative. So even if an individual goes into managed care, we're still looking for you to either, you know, do that initial registration with us. Let's say, you know, you've provided a couple of services. The person gets enrolled in managed care. You would actually already have the initial registration on file with us. However, at the six-month update period, we would expect you to go back in and update the registration for those fields that are required. One of the other things that I want to point out, again, this has been said, but it can't be said enough, you have 90 days from the intake date when the individual was first seen by you to submit your registration. If you wait until the 91st day, bad thing. You won't be able to register the individual, and any services that you provide before the period when you can actually register someone, those claims will not be paid. So it's important not to procrastinate. You know, usually you would have all of the information that you need to register an individual within at least the first 2 weeks and on the outside 30 days. And so it's really important that you go ahead and submit that registration. I continue to say that because, if you know, even if you wait until the 75th day, if you run into a problem, then, you know, and you're trying to figure out what you need to do to correct your registration, you can run out of time. Just because you submit a registration and it doesn't go through the system, that does not buy you any more time. It's really a solid 90 days. Determining if registrations have been accepted, Trish walked through all of that information. She talked about the batch file. You know, there are also provider registration reports that are available through Provider Connect that you can run to give you lists of individuals that you've registered. There are reports that show you when a person's coming close to the re-registration date, so I would urge that you take a look at those. So, again, it's important. Payment of claims requires an active, accepted registration. Claims submitted with registrations that do not have the status, meaning that they've probably been rejected, will have their claims rejected as well. Amy, can we go to the next slide, please? Authorizations. So Pat and Brent walked through the whole process there. You know, just again, things that I like to remind folks of, requests for authorization or reauthorization of services must be submitted and approved prior to rendering services. You know, so if you know that you're coming up on the threshold for counseling therapy, and we know right now that individuals may receive up to 40 units of counseling therapy before an authorization is required. Similarly, a person can receive a combined number of units of 800 units of combined PSR or community support group. if you know you're coming up to those limits, it's really smart to submit your authorization request well before you get to the point, you know, where you need to continue providing services but you don't have an authorization. So we do require prior authorization. I think Amy and Trish went through this as well. So, and there was actually a table displayed that has all of this information in it about who to contact. If you have registration or service authorization questions, the phone number is listed there. If you have questions regarding technical issues, it's the EDI help desk. And again, I would refer you back to the table that was displayed in the earlier PowerPoint because it's got all of this information in one place. Amy, can we go to the next slide, please? Okay, submission of claims. You probably already know this, but claims for DMH services must be submitted directly to Health Care and Family Services. And clean claims must be submitted within 180 days of the date of service. That is required by the SMART Act. Several years ago, you had a full 12 months to submit a clean claim. Now it's a definite 180 days. There is, I think, a provider notice on the HFS website that speaks to this. There are also some communication alerts that are posted on the DHS DMH website, which talk about how to calculate the 180 days. Claims must be submitted using a standard 837P, so nobody, that's probably not a shock for anyone. If you submit claims, you know, you're probably submitting claims using the standard format. There is, you know, as an information source, I have displayed in the slide a link to the HFS website, which basically is geared towards community mental health providers, and so there are some resources there. When you're submitting claims, there are two ways you can submit the claims, you know, just like registrations, I guess. So you can submit batch files to HFS, or you can submit claims on a one-by-one basis via the HFS Medi portal. You know, you do have to be registered with HFS to be able to do these things. There are some special DMH requirements for completing the 837P, and that's met by using the 2300 and 2400 loops and note fields of the 837P. So all of that's referenced in the Community Mental Health Service Definition and Reimbursement Guide, which I'm sure was covered by Kathy Kumpston and Leanne Reiner during the day one registration or orientation. Can we go to the next slide, please, Amy? So, you know, again, here I'm referring to the Service Definition Reimbursement Guide, which is published by HFS in collaboration with DMH and DCFS. So I don't know if you've had a chance to take a look at it, but it contains comprehensive information regarding Rule 132 Medicaid services and other services as well, but these are the ones that pertain to you. So there's really detailed service definitions, staff qualifications, appropriate modifiers that can be used for other services, and then other requirements. And I've basically given you the link to that page. There also is what we refer to as the service matrix, which is posted on the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative website through the provider portal, under provider information, under claims finance. And it gives pretty much the same information as the service definition reimbursement guide, but it's a nice summary, meaning it doesn't really give you the definitions because you've got the guide for comprehensive definitions, but it does show you the applicable HCPCS codes, the staff qualifications, the type of units that can be billed for, the rates, and the funding source. And so there's actually a little column on there that relates to Medicaid services. Can we go to the next slide, please, Amy? in terms of processing of DMH claims, you know, all of the things that we've been talking about today really are part of the business rules that DMH has developed in order to process claims appropriately. So we worked with HFS over many months to translate these to work with electronic transmittals. Every day, and I think that Brent talked about this, or either Pat, I'm sorry, Sue, and so Sue, I'm sorry, I'm referring to you as Pat. So Sue may have talked about this as well. And so HFS transmits daily eligibility files containing information for individuals, and those are the RINs, social service, package B status, et cetera, to the collaborative. The collaborative also transmits daily files to HFS containing registration information and authorization information. And it's really this information where it all comes together that's used to process claims submitted by providers for DMH purchase services. And so really, you know, again, that's why we talk about the importance of completing things on time. If that information is not transmitted back and forth and we don't have accurate information on file, your claims will not process appropriately. So what happens once you submit claims? HFS creates claims remittance advice that you can enroll to receive. And you will need to work, again, with HFS on that, just like you need to work with HFS to get access to the MEDI system. So HFS issues remittance advice showing the status of claims processing. I believe that's now issued once a week. And so I can't emphasize how important it is to review those remittance advices to determine if your claims have processed appropriately and been accepted. You know, if they haven't been accepted, then remember, you only have 180 days to get clean claims through. It might seem like a lot of time, but, you know, if you've not submitted your claims in a timely way, you can easily run out of time. You can also view adjudication processing status of individual claims through the HFS MEDI system. And there, again, you'll be looking at, you know, one claim at a time, but it is possible to take a look. Amy, can we go to the next slide, please? Okay, so I think I've already covered, you know, what happens when you review the remittance advice, but there are, you know, errors that are different than the registration errors. These are claims errors. You may already be familiar with them if you're submitting other services to HFS. But in the provider handbook under Chapter 100 is a list of errors that pertain to claims. And here I've given you a link to the website where you can access that information. It's critical that you know what those errors mean. You know, if at some point you review the errors, though, and can't interpret them, because many times you'll receive multiple errors, not just one error, then we always ask that you contact the HFS Community Mental Health Billing Consultants. So, you know, if there's a claims error, start with them. You know, don't wait. If you can't figure it out, call them as soon as possible. And so here I've given the phone number. If there are technical claim submission questions, HFS also has an EDI help desk. And again, this information was displayed in the little table that was presented earlier. So let's see what else. I think this is about it. There are provider notices that are sent out by HFS periodically. You can register to receive those so that anytime something's issued that relates to community mental health, you'll get it automatically in your mailbox. DMH sends out communication alerts pertaining to anything related to mental health. So if there are some claims issues or other information that we need to communicate to you, we from the central office send a communication alert out to the regional executive managers, who then work with the regional contract staff to get the information out to providers. And so, you know, I hope this has been helpful. I hope all of the presentations today have been helpful. So I'm going to turn it back over to Amy now.
All right, operator, we can now open the line for questions.
Thank you, and we will now begin question and answer session of today's conference. To ask a question, you just need to press star 1 on your touchtone phone, unmute your phone, and record your name clearly when prompted. Your name will be required to introduce your question. To withdraw your question, press star 2. One moment for the incoming questions. Again, press star 1 for your questions.
Amy,
first
if question, no questions, I'm okay with closing the call down.
I'm seeing a question at this time from Nino Tours of South China Hospital. Your line is now open.
And you'd mentioned earlier in the call that if a client is actually showing under another managed care, let's say Blue Cross Blue Shield, FHP, or ICP, you still want us to submit the registrations to DHS, even though they're under a different managed care?
Well, I think the key thing is, you know, is it one of the HFS initiatives where an individual is receiving Rule 132 mental health Medicaid services? If that's the case, yeah, that individual needs to be enrolled with DMH and the registrations need to be updated.
So if there are clients that have already been switched over to those and they have not been registered, are those claims going to be rejected?
No. If you have, if you've already been working with them, I'll just clarify. If you've already been working with a managed care company, and so these would be folks that you've worked with for what, for a while now?
For 132. But we do occasionally get new clients that are coming in, and when we verify their insurance, it's saying they may have Medicaid, DHS social services, but they may also show Aetna FHP or Aetna ICP or Illini Care, County Care FHPs, so all these other managed cares, we just need to know if they need
those
to be
individuals
submitted
need to be enrolled with DMH as well.
And will the response files come back differently with any new different information in terms of what they're provided under, or would it still just show like the ABCs or the other programs that they're under?
It won't show any of the managed care providers who pay for treatment.
Okay.
So as the state mental health authority, DMH still needs to track individuals who are receiving Rule 132 services and look at the change in status.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the question.
Again, for any questions, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. At this time, I'm not showing any questions on queue. Miss?
Okay, thank you. If there are no more questions in the queue, then that will conclude our call for today. I would like to remind everyone that today's call audio and presentation will be posted under the Provider Resources heading on the Provider Information page of the Collaborative website. The audio will be in MP3 format and ready for download within 2 to 3 business days. I would also like to remind everyone that we value your feedback, so please take a few minutes to complete the brief satisfaction survey that will appear when you close on out of the online forum today. And Dee, you may now push the speakers through to post-conference and disconnect the main line.
You for all the participants, you may now disconnect, and thank you for your participation in today's conference.